All right, I guess we'll go ahead and get started this morning. So as Brother Gary told you last week, we're now going to be in Judges chapter 6. We're going to be studying Gideon this morning and his life. Judges chapter 6 through 8 kind of, it's a big summary of his life from the point when he's raised up and then to the point when he dies. Let's see here, get my place. So whenever I was thinking about how to kind of introduce this topic, I know we have a lot of Star Wars fans in the audience, and you know, I thought to myself, you know, what, you know, how could this apply to Star Wars? And I instantly thought of, you know, the third episode, Revenge of the Sith, where, you know, we have the chosen one, Anakin, who basically his whole job, according to the Jedi, is to bring balance to the Force and to defeat the Sith and the bad guys. And, you know, and that's the reason he's brought up in the Jedi Temple and he's trained to do this. And then towards the end of his early adult years, he becomes the very thing that he was meant to destroy, becomes a Sith. So, you know, Gideon is very similar in that way, where he was raised up and he was told by the Lord, you're going to go defeat the Midianites, you're going to go do all these things by my command. And you're going to destroy the idols in your father's house. But then towards the end of his life, he ends up creating the very thing he was meant to destroy. And it's a very sad cycle that we see of Gideon's life, where his life really just comes kind of full circle. But I, you know, I had Star Wars on the brain yesterday, and I just thought, like, how funny is that? But to kind of get into our study this evening, starting in Judges chapter 6, when the Israelites, after Deborah's victory and the peace of about 40 years, the Israelites continued to do evil again, as we saw in Gary's chart last week. And the Midianites end up persecuting the Israelites for about 7 years. And when their allies finally move in, how many are there? Like, what are the Midianites known for in terms of their size? What are they compared to? Yeah, they're innumerable. Yeah. Yeah, you're exactly right. And, you know, I think it's interesting also that, you know, it's their, not only the men, but their camels as well. All of their things, they're just without number. And they're as numerous as the sand on the seashore. And, you know, whenever it's talking about the persecution of the Israelites' economy and how they were affected economically and with their food and everything else, I thought it was kind of interesting. I didn't realize, I've seen a camel before, like I've been before one before. They're massive creatures, but I never ever thought of them as a nuisance or a creature that would destroy farmland. But actually, right now, Australia is having a huge issue with camel groups of their wild camel groups that will actually get in massive herds and break into farms and destroy farmland and all of this. I never considered camels to be a nuisance to crops, but you know, whenever it says that they were greatly impoverished and all their produce was taken or destroyed, you know, that probably involved the camels as well being a nuisance. They would just let them roam. destroying the Israelites' produce and farms. Just an interesting thought, or just an interesting fact I found. But due to this, where are the Israelites currently living because of this persecution? They're living in the open plains, in the fields, you know, right? Yeah. Yeah, they're living in caves, strongholds in the mountains, basically. And we find that in verse 2. And according to the prophet that God sent before he raised up Gideon, what were the three things that the prophet brought up as kind of a reminder to the Israelite people? Yeah, yeah, we had deliverance from Egypt. What was the others? Some of the other things that the Lord had done for Israel up to that point. Yeah, drove out the Canaanites, in which actually would lead to the Israelites gaining the promised land, which Abraham was not able to enter, as that last picture shows. He's watching the people enter the land. And, you know, I found it kind of interesting that God chose to bring a prophet before Gideon, and, you know, he's bringing up these events in verses 8 and 9 of what the Lord has done for them. And, you know, this is, according to some of the sources that I saw, this is roughly about 300 to 400 years after the Exodus. And so in the grand scheme of things, it really hadn't been all that long since all this had happened. And so you got to think, you know, the people, either they have a terrible memory or they're placing their minds and they're putting their focus on other things besides God and what He's done for them. Because really, God doesn't ask much in return of the people. He basically just says in verse 10, don't fear the God of the Amorites. Oh, yes.
And that was something that struck me when I was going back through this, that here the prophet reminded the people, look, God has done all of this. Gideon knew some of that.
Yeah.
Right? He says in verse 13, why has this happened to us? Mm-hmm. He's asking, why then has all this happened? He said, where are all these miracles which our fathers told us about? Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? Yeah, so he knew some of those facts, but he didn't know enough to say, oh, why would have been this in the fall?
Yeah.
He missed verse 1, right? That said the children of
Israel
did evil in the sight of the Lord.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why we're suffering.
Well, and I think I love that point. That's great. I think it kind of goes back to the generational sermon that I taught a few months back where, you know, these people, you know, Gideon, for Gideon to say that, you know, why is this happening to us? It really goes to show, and not to mention, we haven't even gotten to his dad yet, who's got idols. And more than likely, the people go and worship at his dad's house, worshiping idols. You know, you see this period of at least 300 to 400 years where the people haven't been teaching their children. Otherwise, why would Gideon make this comment if it wasn't a genuine comment? If it wasn't a genuine question, why has the Lord forsaken us? Somebody hasn't been teaching him. And, you know, I'm not saying that excuses Gideon for having a lack of knowledge. But at the same time, you know, it's understandable. If I had 3 to 5 generations of where, you know, great-great-great-great-great-grandpa decided, well, I'm leaving the Lord, well, where does that leave me if nobody teaches me? And so we just kind of see this trickle down of generational, you know, not teaching our children in future generations, or they weren't teaching their children in future generations.
At least not explain it to them.
Yes.
Because, yes, here are the miracles, but then there was this covenant thing.
Yeah.
And when we break the covenant, I mean, do you think that in that area that was the first they had ever heard of apostasy?
Yeah.
I mean, they're not the only ones practicing this and seeing the suffering in Israel. So it's, somehow they're teaching facts, but not explaining how this all works and how this applies to our lives.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Now, that's a great point. Yes.
Mm-hmm. They don't remember
Yeah, it's funny how, yeah, you're exactly right. It's funny how we only remember the good and not the bad. Yes. No, you're exactly right. And, you know, I thought about making this comment during Gary's class last week, but there was a, I can't for the life of me remember the author. I had it written down somewhere, but there's a, there was a author that had written a, it was like an apocalyptic novel of the future, you know, dystopian future. And one of the lines in his book was, is that weak men create hard times, and hard times create strong men, and strong men create good times, and then good times create weak men. It's just kind of this cycle that you see, and it's kind of similar to, you know, the story of the Israelites, where, you know, you have this idea of, you know, we need someone to deliver us from this. We have strong man Gideon, he delivers us, we have peace, and then everything just falls apart with weak men falling back into idolatry. Yes.
Yeah. They're not thinking about that application. And so whether they are teaching, technically teaching their children or not, yeah, does it really carry the same depth, the same power,
yeah,
when they're not connecting it and applying it to why their children should live this way?
Yeah, I think I've heard it coined the phrase, you know, are you a Christian or are you a seasonal Christian? You know, through different seasons of your life, are you going to rely on God more than the good times? And then, you know, you just kind of fall off and leave God by the wayside. And I've met some seasonal Christians. You know, the only time they pray is whenever something horrible's happened. It's the only time they reach out to God and talk to Him. Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's a great point. Yeah, God's basically, you know, I've been kind of babying you a little bit. But if you're not going to follow me, then here's the consequence of that. You got to learn warfare. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Anybody else? Great points. Thank you so much. So I guess we'll go ahead and move into, I know we've already kind of touched on some of the latter half of Gideon chapter, Book of Gideon. Book of Judges, chapter 6, where, you know, Gideon is encountered by an angel of the Lord. And this is the first time, at least that is recorded, that Gideon has a supernatural experience or a meeting with a supernatural being. And, you know, Gary already brought up verse 13, you know, when Gideon says, why has all this happened? The Lord has forsaken us. You know, the first thing that comes out of this angel's mouth is, mighty man of valor. Or in the CSB, it says, the Lord is with you, valiant warrior. And it's like, who? Who is this guy you're calling a valiant warrior? Because, you know, he has a fear of the Midianites. In verse 11, we find him thrashing wheat in a wine press to hide it from the Midianites because he's terrified of them. And in verse 13, as I just said, he's, you know, why is all this happening? He's walking by sight, not faith. He has a lack of understanding of God's punishment. And then in verse 15, he's relying on his own strength. You know, he says, well, how can I do any of this? You know, my clan is the weakest. And I'm the least in the house. You know, he's kind of beating himself down here of, you know, who he is and what God's asked him to do. And, of course, this isn't the first time we've seen this happen in the Scriptures where people kind of, you know, say, well, I'm not worthy of doing this. God, why in the world would you ask me to do this? And, you know, I think an application here that I found is that whenever Gideon was encountered by this angel is that, you know, God saw something in Gideon that not even Gideon saw. He saw something that, you know, because God can use people for whatever means that he seeks, that he sees fit to suit his plans. And I don't know, I think Paul was very similar in the fact that everybody knew who Paul was. He knew what he stand for and that he was a persecutor of the church and that he was a persecutor of all Christians. And, you know, really God was the first one, or Christ was the first one to see that he could be a great asset to spreading the gospel. He just needed to be redirected. So, you know, I guess that in the next question is, you know, how would Gideon be able to do everything that he is called to do? Well, in verses 12, 14, and 16, we see where the angel in verse 12 says, the Lord is with you. Verse 14, you know, do not I send you? And that's God speaking. And in verse 16, God says again, but I will be with you. And so, you know, God isn't just saying, well, you're going to do all this, this, and this. All right, have fun, figure it out. God consistently reassures Gideon, I'm going to be with you throughout all this. You're good. I'm sending you to do this. By my authority and by my word, do not I send you. And, you know, I think in verse 16, whenever God, you know, compares the destroying of the Midianites to be compared to a, you know, a defeat of one man. You know, we kind of see this, I don't think I'd call it a parallel, but maybe a comparison between, you know, what God's able to do versus what we think we're able to do. In that, you know, 1,000 years is but a day to the Lord, just as destroying an innumerable amount of soldiers and people is like destroying one man. So we see this, you know, God is consistently trying to show, I'm more powerful than anything and anybody you're going to come up against. So you're good. You're fine. Just do what I tell you to do. Yes, Jim. Yeah, no, that's a great point. Yeah, it is kind of interesting how, you know, he even tells God, you know, can you, okay, I know you did this for me, but if it's really you, Lord, can you reverse it and put the dew on this and this? And, you know, I think it just goes to show that, you know, I think people kind of take everything at such a a secular viewpoint that, you know, I can see an angel light meat and bread and broth on a stone. You light it on fire and it burns without any assistance. And, you know, but if I overhear a conversation, you know, did he pop open the tent door and go, "Hey, you're talking about me? You know, I heard God say..." No, he just takes it at face value. And so, yeah, that's a neat point. Good point. Yes.
Again, I mentioned we don't know his age, but we know he was the least in his household.
Yeah.
And you consider the patience God had with him as he was asking for signs. God understood where he was and was bringing him to the point where he would be the leader that God knew he could be.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. And, you know, that's a reoccurring theme across the scriptures. You know, Joseph would be, I guess, at that point in time, he would have been considered the least in his house. He was the youngest. Firstborn, he got the most. All the way to the lastborn, he got the least. Not that they abused him or anything, but, you know, he wasn't as considered as important as the first. And, you know, whenever Joseph says, you know, "I had a dream that, you know, all your sheaves, we were standing in the field and all your sheaves bowed to my sheave," and, you know, and they're like, who are you? Who are you to say we'll bow down to you? You're the youngest. Whenever God called him to be, at some point, the savior of his family. Yes. Yeah.
But God gets angry at Moses.
Yeah.
In Exodus 4. God doesn't get angry at Gideon.
Yeah.
I think Gideon had perhaps sincerity, even though he had weakness.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Gideon struggled a lot with self-confidence. Genuine, you know, low self-esteem, low self-confidence, whenever it came to God saying, "I need you to go do this." Who are you talking to? Somebody behind me? Is my older brother behind me, you know? You're exactly right. Yes, Patrick. Yeah, God can read our hearts. He knows where genuineness comes in and where it is lacking. Yes, Gary.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on Ralph's comment. We don't know how old Gideon was. I don't know, but I know how young he was not. Because, you know, I used to have him as, I don't know, 20 years old.
Yeah.
But no, yeah. He's old enough to have his firstborn be old enough for him to expect him to help with the fighting.
Yeah.
So by the end of chapter 8, we at least realize that Gideon is not in his 20s.
Yeah, he's not a teenager. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great point. Yes. You know, God has a funny way of being able to know exactly what we need to hear before we even think about it or even say it. Yes, it's a great point. Yes, Raquel. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's a great encouragement. Yes, that's a great point. Anybody else? Great points. All right. Which will actually move us in perfectly to the goodness gracious, Judges chapter 6 in verses 25 through 32. And so, you know, right after the angel of the Lord disappears after performing this miracle, and Gideon makes the statements, you know, "Alas, O Lord, for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face, and the Lord is peace." And right after that, he's told, "You're going to go and replace your father's idols and destroy them." And, you know, as it's been alluded to, you know, Gideon has claimed that he's the least in his house. And you know, I try to put myself in the mindset of these characters that we're seeing. I can't imagine being the least in the house and then being told, "Well, you're about to go defy the head of the house." How terrifying that must have been. Because, you know, out of the respect that I would have had for my dad, I wouldn't want to cross him like that. But, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, there are a lot of people who will make, you know, excuse, "Well, he's my dad. You know, I don't want to do that to my dad." You know, God told him to go destroy these idols. And so that's what he did. And I do want to make a note that Gideon's deliverance, well, it starts with removing evil things, idols and all that. But I think it's important to note that it starts at home. It doesn't start out, he doesn't say, "Now go wage war, but then take care of your house later." He says, "Go take care of your house, then you go fight." And I think that there's a lot of people in this world who make the complaint of saying, "Oh, you know, we live in this dark world and, you know, there's so much temptation, so much going on." Whenever they live in a house with the lights off, they live in a dark house. They won't take care of their house before trying to worry about taking care of the world's problems. I think that's the reason a lot of households fail, is that they're trying to solve the world's problems before they solve their own homes. And I think in Matthew chapter 7, when Jesus taught in his Sermon on the Mount, that we need to be very careful about where we start plucking specks first. I know his context is a little bit different, but whenever he says, you know, how long in verse 4, "Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when there's a log in your own eye?" If you got a log in your house, why are you dealing with a speck in somebody somewhere else before you deal with the log that's in your own house? And so I just think that was a, you know, a neat tie over. And you know, I already made the point that, you know, this isn't just some random person that said, "Don't go rip up, you know, Joe Schmo's six streets down idols. You destroy your father's idols." This wasn't just some random person. In Luke 12 and verse 51 through 53, Jesus says, "Do you think that I have come to give peace on earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. From now on, in one house there will be five divided, three against two, two against three, and they will be divided, father against son," and so on. So, you know, we see where a correct application of the Scriptures is going to oppose apostasy in family. That's just going to happen if family is doing the wrong thing. I saw a hand. Yes.
Just the way you were saying, it's kind of funny because the Asherah, a lot of times, is just a log.
Yeah. I didn't even think about that. That's funny. Nice. That's a great point. It was typically a, I'm trying to think, I had a note in here. It was like a pole, right? Yeah. All right. Let's see here. Yes. Yes.
I don't think they did the chainsaw part, but it was something similar.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those false gods are not. But those false gods are just rocks. So, you know, it's kind of funny in the way the Old Testament is often funny.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's especially evident in verse 27 whenever he says that, you know, his father's household and the men of the city is whom he was afraid of. You know, it's... I think that we can see this all over the Scriptures. The amount of time that people would put into making idols and the amount of devotion that they would give these idols, people got up in arms. It'd almost be like you walking into the South and saying, all right, everybody, bring me your guns. It's like, what? So, you know, people are up in arms, literally. So, you know, it brings to my mind that, you know, he had a right to be afraid of these people if he were to go and destroy these idols. Yes, I saw your hand back there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm so scared of the bad guys out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you're going to graduate to fighting on a national scale, you've got to prove to yourself what right to your point on the
own. Yeah.
Addressing those very real people.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, family can be a scary thing. And, you know, I agree, it does speak to his level of belief and faith in the Lord that he's even willing to do this because, you know, he could have ran. Could have said, nope, not doing that. I'll just skip town. So, yeah, it definitely shows his faith and courage when confronting his father. Yes.
I wish we knew more about Joab.
Yeah.
It's
I agree.
Literally the idols, altar and everything on mm-hmm. his property.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, it is his idolatry.
Yeah.
But it never says that Gideon's afraid of Joash.
Yeah.
He's afraid of people in the house and people in the city.
Yeah.
Who obviously come there to worship. So
yeah.
I get this picture in my mind. I'm imagining what Joash is. He's going along with all this, but when push comes to shove, he doesn't support those men. In fact, the way he renames his own son is kind of a poke at them. And I think I wondered just kind of whether he was actually relieved at that happened, proud of Getting to do it. Sometimes when we confront family to God's point, sometimes we are pleasantly surprised that, although they have been spineless, they have been even unspiritual or ungodly in certain ways, when it's really brought to their attention, sometimes they say, you know, you're right, I want to do better. And so all of a sudden, oh, that turned out better than I expected.
There was a commercial a couple of years ago where this lady walked into a fish market and she was returning a piece of fish that had a hair in it or something was wrong with it. And she walks up to the counter and hands it back and says, I need a refund. And the lady goes, okay, perfect. Yeah, here's your money. And she's just standing there. She's and the lady at the, behind the counter goes, did you want me to put up a fight? And she went, yeah, that'd be nice. And then so they get into it and they're arguing. It's like you know, we don't need to have that attitude towards our family. You know, we don't need to go into a situation where we're going to talk to family about their spiritual condition and go, I hope they put up a fight so I can go, just point out their arguments, they're false. We don't need to do that. We need to go into every situation with the mindset of, if I show them the truth, they're going to change. But that advertisement just cracks me up. You know, did you want me to put up a fight? But yeah, no, that's a great point. But yeah, and it's been said before that, you know, it seems that everybody in town was coming to worship at Joash's house. And I don't know, these men in verse 30, it said that they want to kill him. And I don't know, I think to myself of all the times that, you know, actually after the fact, whenever his father says, you know, I'm going to rename my son and, you know, let Baal stick up for himself. It just kind of sticks out to me is that I'm kind of getting Elijah vibes from this whole section of the story. In 1 Kings 18, in chapter 18, verses 26 through 29, starting in verse 27, and at noon, Elijah mocked them saying, cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is musing, or is he relieving himself, or is he on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and must be awakened. And, you know, it's like we just see this, you know, kind of egging him on a little bit. And I think Gideon's dad kind of has the same, you know, why are you wanting to kill my son? Let Baal defend himself. So I kind of get the same kind of vibes here. And I just think it's funny. Out of all the false gods, you know, Baal really, none of them have a good track record, but Baal really doesn't have a good track record of defending himself. Because he's not real. Yes?
It's always great when everything works out much easier. Gideon, though, going into this, doesn't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
He knows kind of what the consequences can be, that the situation can get real ugly toward him real fast. I think about people who have stood up to idolatry in Ecuador, and man, half of them zealous for their idols, and they get violent real fast.
Yeah.
When you mess with their idols.
Yeah.
And I suspect Gideon knows this about the people of the city already.
Yeah.
And it takes real courage to stand up even in the middle of the night.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Yeah, you brought up the Catholics and everything. You know, I was watching a debate go on where they were discussing the artifacts that they carry around to these different events and places to show, you know, the ear and, you know, the blood and the breast milk. I mean, you just like have all this stuff, and they were debating it, and, you know, the whole time, all I heard over, How dare you say that those aren't real? You call them idols? How dare you? It's like they get upset, really upset whenever whenever people talk about their idols in the way that they do. Did I see a hand over here? I'm sorry, I was talking. Okay, maybe not. But no, that's a great point. Yeah, whenever we start placing physical things and making them, you know, things that we worship, or, you know, especially whenever, you know, kit, you know, there's all the, it's just, you know, it becomes an idol. If there's no other comments, I guess we'll go ahead and move on to preparing for the battle. Three more signs, Judges 6:33 verses 7 through 18. And after Gideon's father, you know, mocks Baal and supports his son's actions, you know, Gideon breaks down the altars of the false gods. And I think we really see this really, really cool scene where we're told that the Spirit of the Lord clothed Gideon. And we see this moment where, you know, he becomes brave enough in verses 34 and 35 to blow a trumpet and rally local troops. And, you know, from local troops from the three tribes. And I don't know, you just see this instant change, because the man who a few verses ago said, well, I'm the least in my house, I think that's verse 15 in chapter 6, you know, my clan is the weakest, and you know, my I'm the least in my father's house, and now he's blowing the trumpet and he's rallying troops because God clothed him with his Spirit and gave him confidence and gave him bravery. And I don't know, whenever we get to the section of the two signs that Gideon asks God to do, the fleece, you know, whenever I first read this, you know, I thought to myself, you know, why would he question God? Why, you know, he's got a miraculous sign, what he said, what he asked God to do, it happened. And I don't know, I think we still see Gideon's humility in this scene. Because in verse 39, it says, "Then Gideon said to God, 'Let not your anger burn against me. Let me speak just once more.'" And so, you know, we see that Gideon has humility before the Lord. But I honestly kind of commend him for wanting to test the spirits and make sure that who is leading him is actually God. And that's a New Testament passage, or that's a New Testament principle that we find in the New Testament. And then skipping down to verse 35 in chapter 7, how many of the tribes does Gideon ask for help, and what are their names?
Three.
Yes, absolutely. Those were the three tribes that Gideon asks originally for help. And then how many soldiers were there at first? The grand total of soldiers? 32,000, yes. We find that in chapter 7 and verse 3. And we see the scene where, you know, God wants there to be fewer soldiers. So he starts setting conditions. And what was the first thing that Gideon told the men of all three tribes? If you're afraid, you can go home. Nothing against you. And then in verses 4 through 7, we see that he sorted by how they drank water. And why does God select the men who lapped water in certain ways?
Probably because there were fewer of them. Because the main point is that Israel is going to take glory for themselves if they have enough strength to say, hey, we did this.
Yeah.
Absolutely,
and that kind of goes back to, I can't remember who made the point, but that, you know, whenever we reach a point of peace and we have complacency that grows, that we begin to go, oh, we're doing this for ourselves. You know, God wanted to make sure there was no misconception that God is the one who did this. This wasn't because some men were more militaristic, you know, or anything, or more astute to seeing what's going on around them, but rather it's that God was the one who was doing all of this. And what was the additional sign that God gave Gideon to encourage him? It was mentioned by Jim a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that, you know, after having all of this happen, you know, God, he's lowering the men count and everything, and then he's encouraged to go into the camp, and he hears this conversation. I don't know, that would be like the icing on the cake for me. It's like, wow, they're even talking about this. You know, I'm meant to do this.
They call Gideon out by name.
Yeah, and, you know, it kind of poses the question, like, how did they know who Gideon was? But, you know, there's some speculation involved that, you know, maybe he had heard that he had rallied the troops. He blew the trumpet. Maybe that's how they knew him. But, you know, we're not really told specifically how they knew Gideon. We just know that God made this dream, and then the one who interpreted the dream happened at that moment. And let's see here. I've got about 2.5 minutes, I think. Maybe 3 minutes. Moving into chapter 7 and verses 19 through 25, you know, Gideon does three things with his men to start the nighttime battle. In verse 20, blows the trumpets. The surround sound startle wake effect, where basically they surrounded the camp entirely. And actually, I think that, yeah, basically this image right there. So they've kind of encircled the camp and made sure that everybody does it at the same time, to where the men are confused and they're terrified and they're told to break pitchers and shout the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And you know, just an interesting point, you know, no telling how many people this guy that was just, you know, had the dream, how many people he told that about. And then it happens. Like, that would terrify me. But, and in verse 21, we're told that each stood in his own place, that being the Midianites and the around the camp, that being the Israelites, and then the Midianites killed each other. The Lord set the sword upon themselves. And, oh, yes?
That's just a great picture. I mean, all they're doing is 300.
Yeah.
The lights, the sound, the shout, and then it didn't even say at that point that they're doing any fighting.
Yeah.
It isn't that the way it often works for us when we confront some problem? If the word of the Lord has the power, then the word of the Lord is doing the work.
Yeah.
And we can just kind of stand back and watch.
Yeah. Yeah, it's...
Stand by and see the deliverance of the Lord.
Yeah. Well, and you know, whenever you look at what God had done, he lowered the men count. He just gave them torches, pitchers. I mean, it's like to every sense of, you know, military, like every military general today would be, you're insane. Well, prepare to be destroyed, you know. But, you know, and I think God intended it for it to be that way. I think he wanted the odds stacked against them. So whenever it came out victorious, God, everybody would know, even surrounding nation, that was God. That wasn't the Israelites. Yes.
The sword of the Lord is actually in the hands of victory.
Yeah, that's great. No, that was a great comment to end on. Perfect. I know we didn't get through all the material, but let's see here. See here, next week we are going to be going over Abimelech, the non-judge, in Judges chapter 9. That'll be Gary teaching. But thank you so much for your comments today. It was a great class. Thank you.